This is Franz Amundsen. Thanks for coming back for another episode of Travel Trade Exchange Podcast. This week, we're going to have the second part of my interview with Eric Hansen. Eric Hansen's the writer of Orchid Fever, The Birdman and the Lap Dancer, Stranger in the Forest on Foot Across Borneo, and Motoring with Muhammad, Journeys to Yemen and the Red Sea. This is a great interview, and this is a second part of about a 95-minute interview. The first part was put on the website last week. But first, I want to talk about the purpose of the Travel Trade Exchange podcast and website. The website is www.traveltradeexchange.com. Now, the purpose of the website is to provide a way for travel stories in the first person to be told in an audio format through a call-in line or an upload in an MP3 file at the website. Also provide a way for travelers to exchange interesting stories in written form through the forum at the website, and provide a way for individuals to meet in person through the database listing or services listing in the website. We want to encourage non-commercial trading of services and expertise between members through listings in the searchable database, and this is at no charge. And we want to provide a place for listing of commercial services through the commercial section of the database. If you know of a small restaurant, hotel, pension in an interesting place, out-of-the-way place, encourage them to post an ad at the website. When I'm traveling and I'm trying to find a little hotel or a little pension out in the middle of nowhere, it's impossible to find that through Google, because most of them do not even have websites. So this is a way for them to advertise for free. And this is also a website to provide a way for charities and nonprofit organizations to list volunteer opportunities that travelers may wish to take advantage of in a travel experience. So people who may use this website include fellow travelers who want to share their stories, travelers looking to make real connections with other travelers, travelers looking for ideas for new travel experiences, and armchair travelers, people that just like to listen to stories. And in the future, I hope this website is used by anthropologists, geographers, and researchers who may find information on this website useful for their research and future historians. Okay, with that out of the way, let's get on to the interview with Eric Hansen. Now, you traveled by yourself for a long time. I mean, you were a solo traveler. And when I sail in the summer, I have guests with me, but I usually give myself a week or two just to go off traveling by myself. And I find when I do that, I open myself up for experiences that I wouldn't have the opportunity of living if I were with somebody else. Did you find that to be the case?
Well, I used to be just a compulsive solo traveler. The idea of sharing anything with anybody was just like, oh no, that's just going to water down my experience. But over the years, I've sort of come to think that I'm much more versatile than that. One of my best friends, Robin Davidson, who she wrote a book called Tracks, and she in the late 70s took four camels across the Australian outback from Alice Springs to the west coast of Australia. And she later, probably about mid-80s, I was living in Sydney, and she needed to get her camels back to Alice Springs. So we came up with this idea, why don't we do a group trip and have all these paying clients, and they'll cover the expenses, and we'll get a fantastic trip through the outback, which is what we did. We had this, it was like a traveling road show. I don't know, have you seen the movie Priscilla of the Desert?
I haven't.
Okay. It's about these two three outrageous drag queens from Sydney who decide to go out and check out the outback. But anyway, they go out, and it's just this crazy, crazy trip that they do in a bus. Well, we sort of did the equivalent on with these camels. We had a person from Circus Oz who was a tightrope walker and a fire eater. We had all sorts of people on this trip, and it was so much fun. We had a couple of ballroom dancers, and we had the New South Wales Junior Ballroom Dancing Champion, you know, 30 years on. And one of the women, there was a lesbian couple that came on the trip. One of the women trained Olympic swimmers, and the other one, she had an office job. But it turns out that both of them knew ballroom dancing perfectly. I mean, they were good. It's like competition level. We had no music, and, you know, in a dry riverbed in the middle of nowhere, they get up, and he goes, okay, do you know Paso Doble, or do you know this or that? She goes, yeah, let's go. And they did this dance under the moonlight in, you know, Central Australia, and I'm thinking, oh, my God.
With no music.
So, no, well, actually, when you're good dance, you don't need music. You just... So anyway, things like that would happen. And I can't remember why we got on this topic, but traveling, solo traveling. It's weird. Once I started writing books, travel company said, hey, do you want to lead a trip for us? I'm going, yeah, right. But then I decided that, in fact, I wanted to go back to Yemen. And I now can no longer remember why. But I thought, okay, I can go there early, visit friends, do the trip, have the whole thing paid for, and I can stay over and continue the work I was doing. Well, at one point in the trip, I realized that with the exception of probably two or three people, everybody gets it in their mind that they don't like me, they don't like the drivers, they don't like the cooks, they don't like the itinerary, they don't like anything. And here they are, this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. And Yemen is a fantastic place. It's never been colonized. It is, I tell people, if you want to experience Islamic culture, don't bother going to North Africa. Don't bother going to Egypt. Just go to Yemen, and you'll be changed for life. Anyway, toward the end of the trip, we're coming down from a very remote mountain village and incredible stone architecture. That's why they took them up there. And on the way down, all of a sudden we come to two Toyota Land Cruisers that have blocked the road. And of course, we're getting held up. So everybody in the car freaks out. Well, they paid for an adventure. Well, here's the adventure, guys. And I said, okay, this may take a while. I'm getting out of the car. Lock the doors. No matter what happens, do not unlock these doors. I mean, no matter what happens, gunfire, whatever, do not unlock the doors. And they go, okay. So I go, and with the translator and the driver, we sit down. Hey, guys, what's happening? And they're going, you have to pay us money. You're in our tribal land, which, fair enough, they were within their rights to, you know, get something from us.
So they're toll takers then?
Exactly. And the thing is that, we explain, well, you know, we already paid, you know, and they go, well, that's a different family. You have to pay us too. And so this negotiation goes on. And finally, one of my drivers, who's from a different tribal area, he loses his temper, which is unusual. In Yemen, people are not all that hot-blooded. They're pretty cool. So anyway, one of the guys who set up the roadblock, they get into a pretty serious discussion. It's all in Arabic. They can't follow it. He marches the driver up the road, and they sort of have their sides to us, and he just lowers his Kalashnikov, and it appears to be pointing right at him. He must have shot, you know, a couple inches to the side of him. A burst of gunfire, and I think, oh, shit, he just shot Muhammad. And Muhammad doesn't hit the ground. I go, oh, that was just to scare him. Well, my driver, he's totally nonplussed. He's looking at him as if nothing, you know, nothing happened. He takes his car keys. He goes, okay, Mr. Tough Guy, you want to steal our car? Throws him in the dust at his feet. And I'm going, oh, man, what's going to happen now? And it was all bluff and bluster. And the guy would not stoop to pick the keys from the dirt. And I'm thinking, wow, he just won that argument. That guy's got a machine gun. He completely outwitted him. And I'm totally fascinated. So they march back, and they're talking about how much money we have to pay. Well, the fact of the matter was I had $10,000 in cash on me. You don't use credit cards in Yemen. And so... as we're negotiating the price, I look back at the car, and here's a guy with a video camera filming the whole thing. And I go, hold on a minute. And I go back, and I say, roll down the window. I go, what the fuck do you think you're doing? I go, we're being held up at gunpoint. You're filming this. Do you have any idea how dangerous this behavior is? They can do anything to us they want. They can not only take the cars, they can take us hostage. They can, you know, they can do all sorts of things. And this kind of behavior is making it more likely. And I realized the people in the car, it's like they were watching television. They weren't actually in Yemen. They didn't realize that this is the real deal and that I was in the process of finessing it so that we could drive on. So he puts the camera down, rolled the window up, he said, and don't unlock the doors. So this goes on for hours. And finally, we get down to the fact that, okay, $300 is what we've got to pay. And so then the negotiation is, okay, well, the bank rate or the black market? And I go, well, the black market rate, because that's how I changed my money. And it just eventually, $200 was paid. We got in the car. We drove off. And as we passed, they backed their vehicles out of the way. And as we went on, I just sort of waved as if, you know, thanks for the good time. And all the smiles that broke out on the faces of the guys that held us up was like, wow, that was cool. We had so much fun. We made a little bit of money, and we just drove off. And immediately, the people in the back seat are going, oh, we have to go back to the capital city. This country is way too dangerous, and we don't feel comfortable here. And I go, shut the fuck up. You guys paid for an adventure travel. You will be telling your grandchildren about, wow, Yemen, that tribal lawless land. Yeah, we were held up at gunpoint. But, you know, when they were there, they didn't want to be there. All they wanted to do was extract the story to take back home rather than being part of the experience. And I think about that. I mean, you asked me about group travel. And even though I didn't like those people, it provided me with an opportunity to, I mean, in this lifetime, how many times... Do you have the opportunity to save 12 people from being taken hostage and to finesse it and know enough about the culture to pull it off, that to the point that those tourists that I were under my safekeeping, they didn't realize that my guide and my drivers, they're not just working for hire. They're duty-bound, honor-bound through tribal law and culture to lay down their life to protect the people that are with them. I mean, I knew the extent that I knew that this situation could have gone a lot of different directions. And I'm thinking, yeah, if the tables were turned, would any of those people, you know, risk their lives for a stranger? No way.
No way. No.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the Yemenis, that's part of who they are. So whenever I travel in tribal areas, basically, you're hiring people from the area, paying them not to rip you off. It's like you said, the toll. It's like, okay, you want to cross the desert here? Fine, my family's been doing this for 2,500 years, and here's the deal. If you're with us, there will be no problem. You want to try doing it on your own? Okay, go ahead. But if you want us to take care of you, it's $500. And that's sort of the law of the land, and that's how you do it.
Wow, great stories. Now, have you, I've always made the comment, your best stories come from your most uncomfortable experiences, which is what you just described right there. For these people, that will be one of their best stories they ever tell in life. Now, what is one of your best stories? What is your, when you think back in a life, 30 years of travel, do you have one story that comes to your mind, or is it just, there's just too many of them to even pick one or two?
Oh, probably the most spectacular one was what I describe in the opening chapters of Motoring with Muhammad, which was being shipwrecked on a desert island in the Red Sea and being there for 10 days. There's no water on the island. There's no vegetation. And the dynamics of being with the French couple and the American couple, I think that everybody who's, you know, ever looked at the New Yorker, all these desert island cartoons, you know, two guys or two women or a guy and a woman or a guy and two women or whatever the configuration is, you know, there's always the coconut tree there and there's some funny little comment being made. I think for the, we sort of went from Gilligan's Island to, we in 10 days to Lord of the Flies. And that was so incredibly interesting. And because I was the only single person, thank God, I, you know, was not, you know, not, you know, taking care of my lover. And I was, and it wasn't like I was detached, but my time on the island was far less complicated than the two other guys. But, you know, we're all trying to, who's going to be the alpha male? And I'm thinking, oh, yeah, right, we'd never fall into that. But lo and behold, after about 5 days, that those sort of dynamics start to evolve. Who's going to be the dominant woman? And I'm thinking, God, like, human beings are so fascinating. And it really made me think about Lord of the Flies, you know, the inherent evil in human beings, but also the inherent good. So I think that was, you know, one of the highlights. But, you know, I'm traveling in Nepal in the mid late 70s, hiking along and running into a Fulbright scholar who was looking at monasteries, ancient monasteries in this one area, which I won't mention. And he said, oh, have you ever heard of such and such monastery? And I go, no. And he was a contemporary of Michael Aris, who has since died. And he was a Tibetan scholar. And he was the husband of Aung San Suu Kyi, the leader of
In Burma. Uh-huh.
And he, I think he studied at Oxford, but he had written this paper about a monastery that he'd been to that was a retreat for in times of strife in Tibet. And well, it turns out I'm 25 miles from it. And I said, do you have a map to this area? And he goes, well, I've got this paper. You can do a sketch map. So I did. And it took me 2 days to hike up to this monastery. And it was like arriving in Shangri-La. Five glaciers converged on this little area. Access to it was about a 70-foot-long footbridge. It was so rickety, and it was a 900-foot drop. It's like three times the height of the Golden Gate Bridge, straight down. And to walk across this bridge, it just is almost like being on a rope bridge. And, you know, things like that. I stayed at the monastery for, I think, about a week. They let me stay in the Gompa, which is the main structure, with these, you know, it's all illuminated by yak butter candles and the tankas, the religious paintings, the religious texts. And the fact that they would let me stay there was just, well, for them, there's nowhere else to stay. And I just remember falling asleep at night and, you know, the flickering lights and looking at the Buddhist iconography on the wall. And I knew some of the stories, but I'm thinking, oh, my God. And it turned out at that point, I'm sure other people have found this place and hope it's not on any group tour, but the I was the first outsider, foreigner, who had ever stayed in that building. And I'm thinking, oh, my God, you know, if I never do another unusual trip again, that was incredibly satisfying. So, but, you know, anybody that travels and stays out there long enough, things are bound to happen. It's when you have those 2 weeks or those 3 weeks to go on a holiday, you want to have it planned out. And some of the serendipitous aspects of traveling, you know, you might have to be on the road for a year or two until those moments happen. But in 30 years of travel, it's happened to me dozens of times. And part of the reason I wanted to start writing was that not everybody has the luxury of time or the good fortune, or in my case, the bad fortune, to have to leave, you know, my country. And that by writing about these experiences, that I can pass on some of them to people who, for various reasons, just they don't have the luxury of time, or the courage or the health or whatever it is to go out and have these experiences.
You know, I was reading your books before I talked to you again, and you remind me a lot like Jack London.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, I mean, he lived an adventurous lifestyle as well, and then ended up writing about his lifestyle. Of course, he wanted to be a writer to begin with. Did you just fall into being a writer, or did you just set out to say, well, I've got to pass these on, I've got to relate these experiences?
Okay, because I grew up in the Bay Area, just a quick Jack London anecdote. When I used to work as a carpenter, I was renovating an old house in the East Bay Hills in Piedmont, a little small town in the middle of Oakland. And I was working in the attic, and the woman came out and said, oh, how's it going? I go, fine, you know, we have to redo this wiring, though. And she said, hey, do you want to see something neat? And I go, yeah. So she pulls out this cardboard box, opens it up, and there are all these old box kites in it. And they're old. And I go, wow, kites. I love flying kites. She goes, you know who made these? I go, who? She said, Jack London as a boy. she was distantly related to him. And he used to fly them in the East Bay Hills, which is something I used to do as a child. And I'm thinking, oh, God. Offer me one of these kites, lady. I won't charge you for all this work. And, of course, you know, oh, no, these are, you know, family heirlooms. And the odd thing is that she didn't take my advice to redo the wiring. 3 years later, the house burned to the ground from an electrical fire. Yeah. Anyway, the Jack London, what was your original question about? About whether I'd set off to be a writer. No. I set off because I felt that by going out into the world, that it would make me a better person, that it would give me a worldview. And I got this pretty much from my time in the Soviet Union. It was the height of the Cold War. I went to Russia, and I had such a fantastic time. I mean, the people were so kind. I was going, wow, all this media coverage of, you know, the evil empire and this and that. And I'm going, oh, my God, these people are so warm, so friendly, so cultured. I couldn't help but think, well, what's the rest of the world like? So that's what made me hit the road. It was in early 80s. I'd always wanted to do a long walk across the island of Borneo for reasons that if anybody wants to know, they'll have to read Stranger in the Forest, which is my first book. So I spend 7 months traveling with groups of nomadic hunters and gatherers. These people have never seen the ocean. A few of them could claim to have seen tinned food. Met a couple of missionaries, and I basically spent all my time with them. Well, I leave Borneo and I fly to Sydney to see some friends. And the second night I'm there, I'm at a dinner party, and seated across from me is this really eccentric, fantastic storyteller from England. And he's just going on and on. And he's just come from Central Australia, where he's been interviewing people about the Aboriginal Dreamtime, which is their story of the creation of the world. And we're talking and talking and talking, and this guy, I think, God, I've never heard a storyteller like this. This guy's so good. Well, it turns out to be Bruce Chatwin, who wrote In Patagonia, and he's probably one of the best travel writers of, I don't know, he died about 10 years ago, but he, between the wars, there was a sort of resurgence of travel writing. And one of those people was Robert Byron, who was very much into archaeology, and he was sort of Bruce Chatwin's hero. And Bruce Chatwin traveled, but what he brought to travel was kind of this idiosyncratic style of traveling, which is partially fictionalized, but the quality of their writing was so high and so erudite and so off the wall that he sort of helped reignite travel writing in the 70s and 80s. A lot of people credit Paul Theroux for doing this, but Paul Theroux is nothing compared to Bruce Chatwin in terms of a traveler and a travel writer. When you read one of Chatwin's books, you feel like you're there. You read one of Theroux's books, and you feel like you're sitting in a train looking through plate glass at the countryside. And so Chatwin, as he left there, he said, "Hey, you want to have lunch tomorrow?" So I go, "Sure, okay." So we have lunch together, and he said, "Do you ever thought about writing for a living?" And I go, "Well, I don't know how to write." And he just laughed, and he goes, "The writing's the easy part. You got to have the material. And based on our conversations last night, you could write a fantastic book about your experiences with these nomadic people." And I go, "Are you kidding?" He goes, "No, there are plenty of people out there that have mastered the craft of writing, but to master the art of travel, there are very few people that ever learn that. And you've got it. So if you want any suggestions, you want to know how to put together a book proposal, you want to name of a publisher, an editor, let me know." And I never took him up on suggestions of publishers or editors, but I just thought, well, maybe I'll just try to write one chapter. And I wrote a chapter. It took me like 6 months to do it. I didn't even own a typewriter at the time. And I just sort of fell into it. I eventually found a publisher in the United States, Houghton Mifflin. But before the book came out here, and I was still living in Sydney, Australia. I got a telex. This is pre-email, which said, "Oh, book being auctioned at Frankfurt. Will advise." I'm going, "Frankfurt? That's Germany." Well, they're referring to the Frankfurt Book Fair, which I'd never even heard of at that point, which is the biggest book fair in the world. I think 1 million titles are offered every year, and the American publisher had acquired world rights from me. And so they were selling British rights. And I didn't realize that you could do this. Well, many foreign language rights you can sell. So at the auction, start off, there were, I think, 12 British publishers who got in a bidding war over the book that hadn't even been published yet. It was just in manuscript form. And eventually, it got down to 3 publishers, and these telexes are arriving going, just this cryptic messages about, reserve prices and this or that. But then I saw these numbers, and I'm thinking, is this some sort of code? And I realized, no, this is the amount of money that it's been bid up to. And I thought it was American dollars. Well, it was actually British pounds, which was another, 50% higher. And finally, one publisher got it, and they sent me, "Congratulations, so-and-so is going to be your publisher, and this is what we got." And I looked at the figure, and I thought, this is more money than I've made in my entire working life, and it's all mine. And I never have to do anything again other than write what I feel like writing about. So I've done a little bit of magazine work, but basically the home that I live in, the life that I lead, all came from sort of a fluke. If I hadn't been at that dinner party, if I hadn't been encouraged by an established writer to sit down and write about this, I have no idea what I would be doing now. And it reminds me of aspects of travel. If I wasn't in this country on that day, on that street corner, I wouldn't have had that experience. So in some ways, it all ties together. I'm not sure exactly how, but it seemed like a perfect natural progression of events for me, who flunked English in high school, who had to go to summer school to make up the grade, who I'm still severely dyslexic. It's so hard for me to read in public because even my own work, I have to unjumble it as I'm reading it. People go, oh, it's so nice that you read so slowly and methodically and thoughtfully. And I just laugh and I go, that's the only way I can. I can tell stories quite easily, but reading is next to impossible. I never studied writing. And so who could have predicted that I would become a well-known travel writer?
I'm sort of surprised after reading, and also in what you've talked about, how strange it was to come back to the United States, that you settled in the United States. I would have imagined that you would have picked some little place somewhere in the world and settled down there, but you ended up coming back to America.
Well, part of it was being shipwrecked, and I had to come back here, and I got a little taste of the United States, and I really didn't like it. So I was here for about 8 months, and I went and lived in Sydney, Australia for about 5 years. And then just before my book, Stranger in the Forest, came out, and this whole auction thing in England came about, I was flown, the publicity department at Houghton Mifflin in Boston flew me to New York, and at that time, Nam Talese, who now is with Doubleday, was the editor-in-chief, and she wanted the publicity people to have a look at me and see how I told stories and whether they were going to send me on basically a world book tour. And now my life has speeded up to, it's like I can't believe all this stuff's happening. So I'm sitting in a conference room at Houghton Mifflin in New York City, and the publicity department is sitting there around the table, firing questions at me, seeing how quickly I respond. They're trying to get me booked on the Tonight Show. They've got CNN lined up. All of this stuff is going to happen. And I'm thinking, God, life was so simple when I was in the rainforest. And now look what this has led me to. And in a way, I was sort of horrified, and I thought, no, this is my fate. This is my calling. The door is open. Excuse me. The door is open. Just step through it. And so I went from a life of almost nonstop travel to a life of almost nonstop publicity. And it was a huge leap for me because I'm a very private person. I've got a lot of friends, but being in the publicity spotlight, that was a challenge. And I can remember CNN, this is in the mid-80s, it was just getting started. And I hadn't even heard of CNN. And I remember just before we went live, I asked the technician, I said, so at this time of day, how many people are going to be watching? And he goes, oh, I'll get a number for you. Hang on. Okay, in 20 seconds, we're going to go live. I'm being interviewed from Atlanta. I'm in a studio in San Francisco. And he goes, probably about 8 million. I'm going, 8 million people. And all of a sudden, I saw myself as the Pope, and I'm standing. And there's, I don't know where I am, but the people, 8 million people, I imagine a crowd of 8 people, million people. And I'm about to address them. And 5 seconds to go, and I'm thinking, I'm going to choke. How do you speak to 8 million people? And then I remembered a very valuable bit of advice that my friend Robin Davidson in Australia gave me. And she said, when you write, don't write to the masses. Pretend like you're seated at a breakfast table like we are right now, and we're both leaning into one another, and you're just telling one person your story, then it'll work. But you try to imagine those faceless people, readers out there, it's going to water down the storytelling. So always think of telling the story to one person. So we went live, and those 8 million people became one, and it went fine.
Wow. That's great. Hey, did you ever find romance on the road?
Oh, God, all the time. I mean, there was one when Birdman and the Lap Dancer came out. I write about one romantic sexual encounter that I had in the Maldive Islands. And in one of the reviews, the guy, it was such an odd comment. I didn't know what to make of it, that I was obsessed with sex. And sort of like I was bragging or something. And then he sort of doubted that it actually happened. And so I sent a response. I said, okay, I'm 26 years old, heterosexual, fairly good-looking guy. What do you think the chances are of me traveling for all those years and never having sex? And it's like being on the road is the same as being at home. You know, people have appetites and things happen. In that case, in the Maldive Islands, we had practically no language in common. The young woman who I was involved with was teaching me the local language. And we just, I'll tell you, it's the most uncomplicated sex I've ever had in my life. And I write about it in a funny way, but the whole sex act is described after she has left the beach and it's at night and I'm looking at my knee and elbow prints in the sand and I just leave it to the reader's imagination what actually happened. But, you know, some people, that's what they look for when they travel. That was never an object of my travel. Like when I went to Thailand the first time, I mean, guys say, oh, I got to go to this club, go to that club. Oh, man, the women, anything, you know. And I just thought, no, I'm not into that at all. But it's just inevitable that on the road, you're going to meet like-minded people, either other travelers or local people. And, you know, people talk about, you know, how uptight some societies are. And I just sort of chuckle to myself. I go, oh, really? Well, when I was there, this is what happened to me. And what are you talking about? There was, I was in Yemen probably 10 years ago. And there's a stain in the house. It was really cute. Somali. Describe her nanny, I guess. I don't know. She wasn't a housekeeper, but she was working there. And in Sana, it's just considered to be proper to be veiled. And I'm standing in the middle of this marketplace, market day, and it's just a sea of veiled women and guys, you know, milling about. Everybody's shopping. And all of a sudden, I feel this elbow against my forearm. And it's this veiled woman. I'm going, oh, she's trying to get me out of the way or something so she can get it, you know, the watermelons or something. And she goes, Eric. And I'm all of a sudden going, oh, my God, who is this? And she goes, it is I, Sinai. And she was this woman who I had this little romantic encounter with beforehand. But I thought, oh, my God, this is the sexiest thing that's ever happened to me in public. I mean, I just laughed. And I'll tell you, people notice. They're going, who is that woman? But she touched that man. But, you know, and all of a sudden you could just see what was going on in people's minds. So, yeah, in answer to your question, I'm a pretty much normal, healthy guy. And that's part of life, really, to, you know, fall in love with people.
That's great. Did in your book, Across Borneo, the walk across Borneo, Stranger in the Forest, you talk about bartering shotgun shells. That's how you made your way across there. As I recall, it's been a long time since I read it, but I remembered that, and I thought, well, that's interesting. That was the currency you used.
Well, it was basically barter trade, and this is, I had learned from bartering my way across Borneo, that going back to my formative years, you know, smuggling erasers from China to India, or, you know, false eyelashes from Bangkok to Rangoon, trying to walk across the island of Borneo, money had no value because people would have to take that money from the highlands and somehow get it to the coast. And they all practiced barter trade. So I met this guy, Muhammad Abid, in a coastal trading town on the north coast of Borneo. And he sat down with me and over several days explained what the values were, the relative values were. Trade goes in the interior. And since I was going to be in an area where people hunted and gathered, shotgun shells was the obvious thing. One shotgun shell was worth a day's labor for a man. And then there were a type of small little seed beads that a tablespoon of those was worth a day's labor for a woman. So that's what I would, I decided that would be the most effective, the lightest, highest value, easily convertible trade good. And I described that in great detail in Stranger in the Forest. There were other things that I could have taken, but they were compact and I had like, I think 8 or 10, maybe 12 cartons of shotgun shells. I can't remember how many to a box, 20, something like that. And also we could, if we were hiking and I gave a guy a shotgun shell or I shot an animal, I owned that animal. We could then butcher it, you know, render the fat, dry the meat in the next village where we were at. We could trade that for stuff. So, you know, the $2 shotgun shell, and you shoot a 400-pound pig, well, all of a sudden, the value of that shotgun shell is increased. And that's pretty much how I got across the island of Borneo. And, of course, you know, the kindness of strangers, people helping me out. I mean, to me, in their eyes, by and large, they would never travel by themselves to such a remote area, you know, far from family and friends and everything that was familiar. And I think that in the end, that was the key to my success in walking across the island of Borneo. I had a couple of close calls, couple with my health, a couple with people just being frightened and mistaking me for some sort of evil being. But that's, you know, that's their currency. They, you know, American dollars, credit cards, you know, not accepted. That's just not how their economy worked.
Are you leading any tours now?
Oh, I took a group to Borneo last March, a group of botanists and primate workers. And from time to time, I'll do it, but it has to have a specific focus. And I had a good time. I hired a lot of my friends to help us in Borneo. Oh, speaking of which, I do not text message, but when I was there, I realized that that's how everybody communicates. In Malaysia, Singapore, people never answer their phones. You know, who wants to go to a computer? It's all text messaging. So I'm talking to a friend of mine who's a botanist, and I said, you know, I'm going to be upriver in this area, and there's a tribal group of people known as the Penan, and this is the tribal group that I traveled with in the early 80s. And I said, is there any way of letting them know that I'm coming? Because there used to be a Chinese trader up in that area that actually had a fax machine. Anyway, so my friend, the botanist, goes, well, no, just text them. I go, yeah, very funny. And he goes, I'm not kidding. So he hands me his phone, and I go, what's their number? So I text them. Well, the last time I saw these people, the way they communicated was they would take a stick and do different carvings on it, attach leaves to it. It's called a message stick. And just leave it in the trail. And if somebody came along, they would get what the message was. Well, fast forward to 2010, they're texting. And they live in villages where there's no electricity, very little plumbing. I don't know how they recharge the batteries. But anyway, so I text them. I go, hey, and it's all in Malay. Basically, hey, I'm gonna be back in your village in 2 weeks. I haven't seen these people in 10 years. And I'm going to be coming with a group of people. I need 2 dugout canoes, and I need this many boatmen, and this is how long I'm going to be here. And can you arrange to have some boats waiting when our light aircraft comes in to land on this little runway? Well, no more than a minute goes by, I get a response. They go, oh, we can't wait to see you. This is incredible. And they're saying to me, wow, you text. And I'm going, oh, my God, this is going to be incredible to see these people again. So 10 days later, we're in this light aircraft, and we're waiting for sort of an opening in the cloud cover so we can see if we can make landing. So anyway, clouds disperse. And as we're making our final approach to this grass runway, I look over at the river, and lo and behold, there are 2 dugout canoes waiting. And I'm going, oh, the people on this trip, this is going to blow their minds. So we get out of the plane, and there are all these people waiting to take, you know, our bags and stuff. Nobody realizes how weird this is. It's as if, oh, yeah, that's just how it's been, you know, like, you know, you fly 200 miles into the rainforest, and, of course, they're always dugout canoes just sort of tied up, you know, ready to take you downriver. And I tried to explain to some of the people, and I just thought, they will not get it. I thought, I don't have to share it with them. And so we got in the dugout canoes, headed downriver, and I thought, you know what? I probably won't start using a cell phone the way they do here in the rainforest when I get home. But that was probably one of the highlights of the trip for me. Like, forget the jungle drums. Just, you know, just text message.
That's great. So when are you going to write a book on dance? That seems to be a passion of yours.
Well, I've been working on it for about, I've been dancing now, I think about 7 years. My mother got cancer, and she went through all this nightmare treatment and decline and death. And during that time, a friend said, hey, why don't you take some dance classes? I was 57 at the time, a Caucasian. I'm thinking salsa? No, I don't think so. And, but I got the bug and I started going, and I had an idea to do a different book for Anna Mouse. And then I realized, no, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to write about. And it's similar to my book, Orchid Fever, which is also sort of similar to the movie Best of Show, which is about the show dog people.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a subculture of people who've got their own language. And in this case, their own music and culture and history. And so I've been working on that for about 7 years. It'll probably take me another couple of years to finish it. But I decided, unlike Orchid Fever, where I really never learned to grow orchids, and I was really an outsider looking in, I thought, no, I want to totally immerse myself in this, which is why my living room is now a dance studio, the hardwood floor, great sound system. I'm in a rush to finish it, but when I go to Cuba, that's what I'll be doing the whole time. I'm taking part in this literary conference, but early in the morning, dance classes, and every night, the local clubs. And it's something I never could have predicted. I didn't go looking for it, but when I wanted to write another book, I'm just thinking, what gives me the most pleasure right now? And I thought, yeah, the dancing. It was a saving grace, you know. Sort of, oddly enough, in the face of death of a parent, what I turned to. I could have turned to alcohol, women, drugs, you know, all sorts of bad behavior, or just felt sorry for myself. And I discovered the joy of dancing. And that's sort of the message that I want to, one of the messages I want to get across in the book.
Oh, that's great. Thank you, Eric. This has been a great interview. I'm going to probably break it up into 2 separate podcasts. We've been going over an hour, and there's not much I want to edit out. But if you have any other comments, I mean, it's really great to talk to you.
Oh, no, just thank you. It's, you know, I love talking about travel, what I do for a living. And I know a lot of people are, you know, they want to be writers and they want to be travelers. And, you know, in terms of people who want to write, I recommend don't take any writing classes.
That was a great interview. I really enjoyed talking to Eric Hansen. And I really encourage you to go read his books. They're great reads. I just finished reading this weekend The Birdman and the Lap Dancer, Close Encounters with Strangers, a series of short stories that are very interesting and very well written. And finally, thank you very much for listening. Please tell your friends about us, and please contribute to the website by uploading your own travel stories, either in written or audio format in an MP3 file. Thank you for listening. Until next week, remember, you will be remembered by the stories you tell. Goodbye.